Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson, back with another episode of our Hollywood Explained mini-series, where I have my great co-hosts, Laura Walker-Lee and Andy Horwitz. If you haven't listened to previous episodes, I'm gonna give you a chance, because usually I give like a really quick intro to these two, but we're going to do it again, because I think it's been long enough. Laura, you've had such an interesting background as far as I'm concerned. How would you give people some of the highlights of your film and film finance background?
Let's see. I've been working in entertainment for 22 years. And I've worked in production. I've been an executive at a studio. I was an agent at Creative Artists Agency, I started that in 2008. And that's really when I got into the finance of film. And I've really stayed in that pocket ever since. I have branched out into venture capital and private equity, raising money for for founders early stage, mid stage, and late stage. But I've been also raising money for filmmakers over the last 14 years. So I've definitely seen dips in the market, the 2008 dip. I've seen the rise through the 2010s, and I'm constantly evaluating just the health of the marketplace and the different dynamics at play on behalf of investors. So that's my professional background.
I love how you got through that whole thing without really giving people a sense that you work with like some of the biggest movie stars in the entire world. And like, we've been friends for how long? And every single month you tell me about, oh, you know what? I worked really closely, and I won't say the names. You know, I know so-and-so. I was just texting their husband. I was like, you have their phone number? Right? Like this, like it never ends, people. Week after week, month after month, Laura has like close relationships with some of the most famous people in the world that she like failed to mention to me.
I feel like a litmus test to people who are not really in the industry is they drop a lot of names. And I think on a subconscious level, like, yes, I am in relationship with those people. Some of them were nominated and won Academy Awards a couple of weeks ago. And yes, I work with them, and maybe they, I don't know. I feel like discretion is appreciated. I've movies that I have worked on, I've put together financing for Dallas Buyers Club for Matthew McConaughey, Still Alice, which Julianne Moore won the Academy Award for. I worked on American Hustle, which Andy took across the finish line and did incredibly well. And I worked on movies like Black Swan. And anyway, I'm currently working with filmmakers that I really love.
Yeah, and then 100% of people listening today would know their name, like literally 100%. If you have an iPhone, you know who this person is. Okay, Andy, will you give us the somewhat less humble version of your background?
I like to keep my background humble. By the way, just tagging on to the what Laura said, that usually you could tell people aren't really in the business because they mention a lot of names. There's also if you look at their social media and they have tons of pictures with their arm around a lot of celebrities, usually they also are not really in the business, because that's just like they met that person for 30 seconds and try to give off the perception that they're friends with that person. But mostly it's just like, let's try to rack up as many photos as we can with famous people and pretend like we know them. I have been in the business for 17 years now.
And now with AI, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. It's a wild world we're living in now. I've been in the business for 17 years now, almost entirely as a producer on the producerial side of the business. I started my career working alongside most recent Oscar-winning producer, Chuck Roman, who just won the Oscar for Oppenheimer, which is very exciting, and the last film that we had made when I was at Atlas. And I was there for just over 15 years and started as a young intern, essentially, and slowly but surely worked my way up to the very top. I've done almost every job there is to do at a production company, from creative executive vice president, senior vice president, executive vice president, and a producer. I have produced movies, small movies, medium-sized movies, and big movies. Some of them include American Hustle, as Laura said, and Suicide Squad, and most recently Triple Frontier, and then some smaller films like The Hollow Point and Mojave, and then have made a podcast a few years ago, and got into the podcast, the true crime version of a podcast a few years ago. So I've kind of done it all in the film business. And just recently, about 18 months ago, launched my own company called Big Swell Entertainment, which is a solution to, I think, a producerial problem that, that is existing in town right now. And a new model that is very much geared towards where Hollywood is going and the volume-based business that I think it's going to require to be a successful producer these days.
Very fun.
Yeah.
So these are really fun for me because I grew up fascinated with Hollywood. My mom was always bringing home tons of movies. It was like our family thing, going out to the movie theater. My whole goal in life is get rich enough that I can do my child rescue charity and still have enough money left over to make Jason Bourne movies. But the pressure is really low on me. I have no idea what we're going to talk about. What do you guys want to talk about this week?
Well, first of all, Andy, I forgot that we worked on Mojave together. That was an amazing script and such a good movie. And also, Andy does really interesting stuff sometimes with experimentation. He actually made his own podcast, which is a fascinating story. It's called Chameleon. And you should download it if you want to go on a really wild narrative ride. He's done that, and other things in addition to all of the really great movies he's made. What I want to talk about, and I'm asserting this, I texted you guys earlier saying I really wanted to talk about this, is that the Guggenheim Annual Media Conference just happened in Palm Springs this month. And it ends up being a really macro look at media across industries. But something that was a really prominent observation out of the conference was that studios are starting to license their content to Netflix. And it reminded me of where we left off in the last podcast. We talked about the strikes. We talked about just the negotiations that happened between the AMPTP and the unions, and where creatives landed in that ecosystem and where they won and where they lost. But right after that negotiation, Netflix decided for the first time in its history, which the industry has been begging for years, which is to release their data. And so they're going to end up doing it twice a year. They will release the streaming numbers on how well different projects did. And one of the reasons why leadership said that they did that is because we've been asking for it for a long time, and it was starting to create friction between creatives and the streamer. But also, they've pulled out so far ahead of the streaming wars that they're really not vulnerable to competition for releasing that kind of data. And another indication of them really winning the streaming wars is that Disney Plus and Warner Brothers, they've really been trying, and also Paramount Plus, have all been trying to compete with Netflix over the last several years. Paramount has not acquiesced to sub-licensing their content to Netflix, as far as today is concerned. But Disney Plus and Max, which used to be HBO, and some other streamers have. And so this reminds me of the dynamic that happened post 2008. The studios for 100 years were incredibly powerful, and independent movies really could not get made. And it was really because the studios owned talent. They had talent deals. So Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise and the biggest names in Hollywood, they all had these home deals at different studios, and they were called first look deals. And so these people, in exchange for annual compensation, would have to go to their home studio first and give them a first look at a project they either wanted to direct or star in. And it was really at the studio's election whether or not that director, writer, or actor could go to other studios and make the movie that they wanted to make. So they basically locked up a lot of talent in those overall deals or those first look deals. When 2008 happened, the parent companies that own the studios didn't really understand that dynamic. And they were really just looking at balance sheets. And so GE that owned Universal at the time and Viacom, which owned Paramount, they were really just looking at the line items and they were saying, why are we paying an eight-figure deal to so-and-so? Why don't you just go ahead and let that deal lapse over the next 18 months? Or why are we paying a seven-figure deal to this actress? Why don't you just go ahead and let that deal lapse over the next 6 months? And so creatives started to flood the independent market, and they became like these like free agents, basically. And they could make movies with whoever they want, however they wanted, because they were no longer beholden to the overall deals. And it really changed the ecosystem of the industry. What's happening now is that, well, between then and now, Netflix started to snatch up a lot of these people that were free agents, paying them a lot of money to either have an overall deal, or they would do something that was more detrimental to creatives in the industry, in my opinion, which was if you were a creative, you used to do a deal with a studio that had front end and back end compensation. So you would get paid up front to actually do the job. And then there was a very transparent system for the studios to report back to the industry about how much a movie was making. And the system was called RenTrak. And so the publications within the industry, the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Deadline, they would report based off of RenTrak, oh, this movie just made $100 million. Well, if you're an actor like, you know, Will Smith in a movie and the box office reaches $100 million, you might have a bonus that gets triggered from that point and you get paid additionally. And you also maybe have a piece of ownership of the movie. And so you can actually measure how well a movie is doing. In the 2010s, Netflix started making what are just called upfront offers. And they would say, we're going to pay you this lump sum to either acquire this finished movie, or we're just going to pay you this lump sum to do this job. And you're not going to get any visibility into how well your project does on our platform. And that really changed the ecosystem for a second time in this century. And what's happening now, I think, is a third, and it's happening at the studio level, which is studios own intellectual property, which can be monetized in banking deals and things like that. But studios have always had their own visibility into their own what's called windowing. And they've had control over all of their distribution deals. Well, now they're starting to license to Netflix. And the big question in the industry is, why is this happening? Well, it's happening because they're trying to service their short-term debt, and they're also trying to increase their stock prices. And people just think that the long-term trajectory of that is not going to be good for the studios that are sub-licensing to Netflix in the long term, because Netflix may do the same thing to studios that they did to creatives, maybe just in a slightly different form. And it really comes from visibility, because Netflix is not played by the same rules as everybody else in the entertainment community. And they've pulled out ahead from a stock price measurement, but it's affecting the industry. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I meet a lot of investors who are, they exist outside the industry and they look at Hollywood and they want to invest. And their first port of call is usually, can I invest in a studio? And they're so enamored with the possibility of being in business with Warner Brothers or being in business with Paramount that it's almost to the exclusion of other types of opportunities in the industry. And, you know, Andy and I both know what the long-term trajectory of those types of investments are. But I think that as investors come into Hollywood, they need to be open to other types of models. And I have opinions about why what Andy's doing and some other people are doing are, they'll be able to take advantage of this Hollywood dynamic. But I'd love to hear Andy's thoughts, because I don't want to soak up all the airtime.
Well, I think, first of all, I'll just touch on what you said in terms of the sort of slate financing deals that are that are usually tying themselves to studios. You know, I think, you know, I guess I would pose a question, Laura, and I've been, as you said it, my brain was starting to move about, can you think of one of these companies that have come in and invested in a slate financing deal with a studio and put hundreds of millions of dollars in, where a company has lasted more than 5 years? Because I honestly can't. I mean, usually what ends up happening is there's very few. I really honestly can't think of one right now where a new giant chunk of money, let's call it $200+ million, came into town, signed a slate financing deal with a studio, and still exists 5 years from that point. So what I mean by that is that is sort of like, in on paper, the safest money, because you're investing a giant chunk of money into a studio that has infrastructure, distribution deals, big IP, yada, yada, yada. First of all, those movies that you're investing in would get made whether you're investing in them or not. They're getting made at a studio. They're just using your money to mitigate their own risks. Again, I cannot think of a single company that came into town with a giant slate financing deal of $200 million or more that they plugged into a studio that where a company has lasted more than 5 years. Usually what ends up happening is your money gets drained within that studio. It gets put onto problem movies, movies that they necessarily don't want to fully finance themselves, movies they feel like are a tremendous risk, and they're using money to mitigate their risk. It's a situation that's been happening in town for as long as I've been in the business, and it will keep happening because, again, it looks safe on paper. If you were to take that same amount of money, let's call it $200+ million, and plugged it into financing films yourself, first of all, you as a company or you as an individual own at least 50% of that movie at that time. You do not get that if you plug that into a studio, not even close to the amount of money you're getting. And you now have the ability to say, I was responsible and most responsible for the reason that movie exists on this planet. Those other movies that you're slate financing, like I said, they're getting made whether you put your money in or not. They'll find money from someone else. They'll use their own money, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, it's been one thing that I've been sort of like shouting from the rooftops, you know, at least for the past like 2.5 years, is that like, I get why people do that. But at the end of the day, there's a better way to do it. And there's a way that if you want to make movies and change the world and have something to say and, you know, influence culture and do all those things, which is what the reason I'm in this business and the reason that so many of us do this, there's a better place to put your money than into a slate financing deal at a studio. You know, going back a little bit to what Laura was saying, you know, the streaming wars are over. Netflix won in spades. They were going to win the whole time. They were easily outspending everybody. They put the studios in a position where they're hemorrhaging money and not making, they're spending, you know, I think Paramount last year lost $800 million on Paramount Plus. They're just not making any money. And so licensing titles to Netflix was sort of where it was always going to go. That was always going to be the plan, in my opinion, for Netflix. They knew they would have all this money coming in. So, you know, the business is changing, and I believe that we are in another changing period at the moment. I think we are not going to be in what the new normal of Hollywood is going to be, and probably till the end of this year. And the new version of Hollywood is contracted back down to like sort of where we were in like 2014, 2015, in terms of the amount of things that are getting made, because way too many things were getting made. The streaming wars, you know, created a situation where everyone was just trying to outspend each other. And again, Netflix was always going to win that war, and they were happy to let the studios try to outspend them. It was never going to happen. So the new version of Hollywood, I think, means that we will be making less and hopefully better things. I also believe that the new version of Hollywood is going to create a situation where we're going to get a lot more mid-sized movies, a lot more independent film. I think that is what the audiences are telling us they want right now. They're having fatigue with IPs and franchises and all of those things. The movies just aren't making as much money as they used to. So, you know, I do, you know, my company, Big Swell, is really geared towards and specifically designed to be able to take advantage of all of those things. It allows us to be able to go, you know, make movies at a cost that make more sense, have young, experienced producers that aren't going to cost the studios fortunes or independent financiers fortunes, and create, I think, in my opinion, what you need to do as a producer these days, which is a volume-based business as opposed to a one movie every few years business. So that kind of touches upon it. I think sort of in the state of the business right now, again, we're in this transformative period at the moment, and I do hope and I do believe that we will be in the new normal probably by the end of this year.
I want to follow up on that a little bit, Andy. When there are obviously such big studios out there, and they're the Netflixes of the world out there, I know about a couple of your projects we've talked about this year where you've got really, really desirable talent, whether that's in front of the camera or behind the camera. Can you talk about basically winning the war for talent when you aren't Warner Brothers or you aren't even Atlas anymore? You know, you're how are you approaching things that these people that are so sought after are not just going to the biggest name in town and you're able to get to work with them?
I think for me anyways, in what I made a decision to do when I started Big Swell, which is to take a breath and I think develop material that I knew would be able to get us those names, those big actors. I think big actors aren't always looking, most of them are not just looking for a paycheck. They're looking for roles that are going to give them a piece of the zeitgeist. They're going to create a conversation that will get them to the award show, that will, you know, define them as serious actors. And I think that requires you to find scripts that have roles like that. And I think if you have roles like that, that are special, that are unique, that are different, that are what I like to say loud and noisy, meaning that people are going to talk about them when it comes out, I think you will get those actors. And I think that it requires two things. It requires a great script, and it requires a producer that has access to talent agencies and talent themselves, where those agents and that those pieces of talent will feel comfortable knowing that, okay, if I attach myself to this thing that may be a little bit riskier, you know, is going to be me taking a leap on a role that that is a little bit scary, but I know if I hit the bullseye, I will win. They're going to want to know that they're in good hands while they're doing that. And so from what I've seen, you know, the studios right now and financiers know who they want to be in business with right now. They already know. They're aware of it. And it doesn't really matter sometimes what you have, as long as you have them in it and they're attached and there's a director that they like, they want to buy the movie before you even go out with it. I mean, there's a project that I have where I have a bunch of studios and independent financiers asking me if they can make offers on the project right now, just because they know who's in it and what it is. They haven't read it yet. And they already want to buy it. And so to me, it's like trying to find projects like that, because the agencies talk and they communicate with the studios and they have their big sort of general meetings with studios once a month, and they tell the studios what they're working on. And so this, the moment they mention something in there where, hey, Andy's got a project with X actor or actress, the studio's already in their brain clock go, we want to buy it. They don't care what it is. They want to buy it. And so then, of course, then they call me and they say, well, what's the plan with it? What are you going to do with it? What's the process? And I think once you get to that point, you have to be very careful in terms of the way in which you go make your movie. But again, it's all about material and it's all about access to those pieces of talent. And if you have both of those things, I think you can create demand within the marketplace that is much different than sort of putting a package together, hoping that the town is going to respond to it, sending it out to a bunch of places and hoping you get a buyer. I think it has to be super calculated. And to me, that is where I have found most of my success in starting a new company, is just finding really interesting material that I know will go get those big actors attached. And if you get one of them attached, you'll find a home for it pretty quickly. And that to me is like, it's all kind of talent-based these days. It's not necessarily concept.
I'm going to ask Laura a very related question, because you know, Laura, I'm thinking about a book deal that you were really close on that is now a very famous Leonardo DiCaprio movie, right?
Yeah.
And this idea, two things. One, and Andy, feel free to weigh on this as well, but Laura, when you're thinking about the same thing of like getting a hold of the kind of material that can turn into the kind of script that the biggest actors in the world want to be a part of, what are a couple of your principles for that gut feeling on like, no, this is something worth maybe spending a little more to get the life rights for, or to get the book rights for, mm-hmm. than other ones?
Gosh, well, the calculus is always different because it's art, you know, it's not a science. On that particular one, which I've already spoken openly about, so we'll just, you know, name it Killers of the Flower Moon. At that time, what I knew is that the Oscars had just finished that season. And I actually think it might have been the Oscars So White, the hashtag Oscars So White Oscars, or maybe it was the year after. And the feeling in town and also just culturally was that diversity really needed to have its moment, its decade, hopefully, you know, much longer than that. And I knew that that book, it had roles for Native Americans, a lot of them. But you could also anchor the financing to some of the main characters, which were white men. And I hate, that's just a harsh reality. I remember when I worked on The Butler, the Lee Daniels movie, you know, that was about a black butler who was working in the White House. And we couldn't close the financing on the movie until we cast more of the presidential roles because they were white men. And that really comes from like a date night principle, which is when couples are trying to decide what they want to watch, white men at that time in like the early 2010s, that they would just, you know, favor those kind of demographics heavily. So it actually registered at the box office. So with Killers of the Flower Moon, it was really two things. One was it spoke to my principles of diversity. It was a great story. It was a great book. It was hidden history that people they weren't aware of because President Hoover created the FBI based on this one case. And also, like, it was just such a well-told book. The last thing that was part of my calculus with that particular movie and why I put such a big offer onto the book, because the studios were bidding in like the low six figures, I ended up coming in with a seven-figure offer before someone outbid me significantly. But the reason why what took me to that calculus was there were already actors who were signaling that they wanted the book. And so if we could control the property, I would end up saving myself a lot of time in packaging, which is, packaging can take weeks, days, it can take years. Because if you have a big budget, you have to cast famous people to put on your poster, to have in the thumbnail on Netflix, because that's how consumers make their choices. So the bigger your budget, the more necessary it is to cast very famous people. And those famous people are busy, and it takes them a while to read screenplays. And also, if they're in high demand, they may be booked out for 2 years, and so you have to wait. But there were actors on that project signaling all at the same time that they wanted this book. And I read it before that signaling started. But once the signaling started, I thought, let me just make an offer 10 times more than what the studios are offering. And that was my calculus around that decision.
So I want to go back to Andy 1 second, but just for non-industry people, like, the packaging is getting the actors, getting all this stuff, and getting the money, what, like, in the tech world we call our, you know, fundraising, financing, you know, in real estate, places like this. But Laura, other people don't know what you mean when you say signaling. Like, is this like you're getting a text message from your friend, you overheard it? Is this like something in the Hollywood Reporter? What does signaling mean?
It comes in all different forms. In that particular case, There were rumors of rumors. Then you have to confirm. And then the trade papers like Variety and Hollywood Reporter start to report on it. But you really have to catch it in that like magic instance before it starts getting reported, because then the bidding gets out of control. I was probably 24 hours ahead of all that craziness. And when the reporting started, that's when other people started to come in, and someone bid over twice what I offered for the book.
Yeah.
yeah. But, you know, I really want to underscore something that Andy was talking about, but didn't make a point. You didn't make a point to say it, Andy, which was you have this project with a very famous actress, and studios want it, and they're calling you. Choosing your moment in the industry to sell a project is so critical because you usually only get one bite at the apple. If you're an investor and you hire your best friend to be the director of development or whatever, and they don't have any relationships in the industry, it might feel very exciting for Warner Brothers to call and say, you haven't made this movie yet, but we really want to make this offer. And you might sell it for way less than you could have. And having sustained relationships with people, look, it's annoying that Hollywood is an insider industry, but we've covered in other episodes why that is, because exposure to lawsuits and intellectual property make it very complicated. So you have to do business with people that are known and are trusted in the business. And, you know, I think that we're friends with people who are executives at these companies. We can text them, we can call them, we can have a two-way conversation that doesn't feel so intimidating. It doesn't make me smarter than anybody else. It just means that I've done life with these people, and so has Andy. And so it becomes a very, like any business, it becomes a very warm atmosphere to be able to have a potentially difficult conversation or a competitive conversation with somebody and really leverage yourself to the next point where you think you're going to get more money. And so if being an investor, if making money back is important to you, that's the calculus around making sure you have someone on your side, either a trusted producer or someone from the industry who has these relationships to navigate that for you. If you're, on the other hand, if you're an investor who cares more about creativity, you might think, oh, well, you know, Andy and Laura are just saying that Netflix is controlling everything. How about I just, you know, go finance a movie? How about I just get into business with Netflix with like an actress who has an overall deal or, you know, some other way? What I've been hearing, and actually reporters have gone on record to say that they're hearing the same thing, is that if you are developing something in Netflix, the type of notes they're giving on original projects that they're making is that it's not second screen friendly enough. So what does that mean? They're looking at the data of how long a viewer will engage with their content. And what they know is that there are a lot of viewers who are on their phone while they're watching a show, or they're on their laptop while they're watching a show. They have two screens that are active at the same time. And so the notes that are coming back to some creatives is that this is too complex. You need to dumb it down because we know that we're not getting the full engagement of our viewers. And that's important to Netflix because they have to keep their stock price at a certain level. And where I think that Netflix misses the mark on that creatively is that Andy was talking about how you know, quality over quantity is really the order of the day for 2024, 2025, and everyone is making less content. Well, I think that if you're making a movie with a really great producer who knows market timing, but also just has really great creative instincts, you have two benefits. One is you can participate in this new renaissance of creativity that I think is going to emerge over the next several years because less movies are being made. And the second thing is that you can choose your buyer once a project is more fully formed, and you want that competitive landscape for yourself in recoupment. So anyway, that was a very long-winded explanation, but I wanted to make...
No, it's super helpful. Andy, we probably have one more time for... We have time for one more train of thought here. With all what Laura said, why don't you weigh in on it and how you see it similar and different, and maybe add any insights you've got.
Totally. Well, I'll start with the Netflix thing because she just talked about it. I'll go back to the packaging thing because I think that's important too. But the Netflix thing, I think Netflix is a very specific type of studio now. I think that they're, as Laura said, you know, a lot of their content is made to be playing in the background while you're doing something else. As a filmmaker, that makes me queasy to say that out loud. We work years and years of our life. We leave our families for a year plus. We have our blood, sweat, and tears in these projects. The same amount of blood, sweat, and tears in these projects on a little independent movie that releases theatrically is also in a Netflix movie. So the process of making them is exactly the same. What she said is completely correct. There was a TV show that I had that I had sold to Netflix, and we had developed an amazing pilot. And the whole idea was there's this big reveal at the end of the pilot on sort of like who the bad guy is, right? You're not quite sure who it is, and you're trying to figure out the end of the pilot, which is a 60-minute pilot. You finally land that. The notes that we were getting back from Netflix, and the reason the project is not at Netflix anymore, is they said, listen, our audience cannot wait to get to the end of the pilot to know exactly what's going on and figure out who the bad guy is. You need to tell them who it is in the first 10 to 15 minutes of the show. And I was like, it hurt to hear that, because I said to them, I said, that's then the whole pilot, then there's no reason to make it, because the whole reason to that when they get to the end of the pilot, it's going to punch them in the stomach on what they were actually watching the whole time. There's a huge reveal. It's why you're going to get people talking about this and screaming about this after they watch it. No. Our audience, if you don't tell them exactly what's going on and who the bad guy are and what's happening in the first 10 to 15 minutes, they're out. They're going to turn it off. And so that ties right into what Laura was saying, which is like, they have such short attention spans. They're doing other things while they're watching your stuff. It's why, in my opinion, I made a Netflix movie and I'm very proud of it, but like, there are very few Netflix films that anyone talks about 1 month after they come out. You're trying to make movies that people talk about that are reference points. You want them to be talking about them years from now and referencing them 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Netflix has not made one single movie that's going to happen with so far. And they don't even make movies that people talk about 3 weeks after they're released. And so as a filmmaker, it's painful. It really is. And I think that I do believe, honestly, with Dan Lin going in there, I do think that's going to change. I think at Netflix, I think the idea of them making $300 million movies starring The Rock that get, you know, 1 week of play and then they're gone, so they can get those huge numbers and the subscriber numbers and the view numbers, I think that's over. I think those don't really do anything for Netflix anymore. I think they were being made because they wanted audience to see, if you want to see The Rock's new movie or you want to see Ryan Gosling's new film, you got to go to Netflix. That's over now. Like, they've established themselves as that. I think they're going to be making many, many, many more mid-level things, many more things that are that they can make for a price, and they can hopefully get a bang for their buck out of it. And they'll leave those big, giant $300 million movies to the traditional studios. They just don't need to make them anymore. So I think, just going back to the packaging thing, I think, you know, when you're putting a movie together, at least what I do anyways, is you can mitigate your risk. I talk to agents all the time about, you know, pieces of talent that I really want to be in business with. What are they looking for? What are they interested in? What are they talking about? And you can get things from their agents like, hey, so-and-so really is like obsessed with boxing right now. He really wants to find a boxing film. Or, hey, this client of mine is like they're married to another actress and they want to find a movie to do together. What can we find them to do together? Or you can find something that so-and-so has never done a rom-com and they're desperate to find a rom-com. And so I hear all those things, and you take all those things, and I write notes down, and I'm looking for projects that I know I could fit into that box. That if I find the right thing, the right boxing thing with the right script, that's a great script, I'll get that person because I know they're looking for it. And for example, there's an actress that I really want to be in business with, and I know there's a specific thing she's interested in, and I was looking for it. And then all of a sudden I get a call from a writer who's in the middle of doing a life rights deal for a person that happens to look just like this person who happens to play in the sport that she wants to find a movie in. And so I called up the agent and I said, listen, like, I think I have the right thing. Here's what it is. If I can secure the rights and we have a great pitch, will she be interested in it? A call comes back 2 days later, 100%. If you can get those rights, bring them back to me. And so now I know, okay, I can spend more time and a lot more energy and even some of my own money to like lock this down, because I know I have a path forward on it. And so that, to me, I think is what really smart producers are doing today. They're being very specific in terms of who they know has value in the marketplace, who the studios are wanting to be in business with. And you find out who those people are, you find out what they're looking for, and you target them. And maybe it doesn't work and it doesn't necessarily need to be that person. Maybe it's someone like them, but at least you're mitigating your risk. You know who you're going to get for your movie, because who you're going to get from your movie is going to absolutely dictate your success in getting the movie made. Everyone is obsessed with stars these days. You know, it's really what they want. It's been like that in the history of Hollywood. It's even more so now. you know, there are pieces of talent that I have on some of my projects where I think that they're great. And some financiers are like, not a big enough star for us. Sorry. You know, like, come back to us if you replace the cast. So lots of things you can do to mitigate that risk. And I think it requires getting really creative as a producer and being much more strategic and targeted. And I think that the project that I have that people are really interested in, I knew, like, talking to a lot of studio friends of mine, they've been trying to get into business with her, this person, for a long, long time. She passes and everything. They haven't been able to get her. I knew if I can get her, I will have a line around the block for people who want to buy the movie. They don't even know what it is. Just because you got her on something and she passes and everything, we're in. We don't know what it is, you know. And then when I put a director on it, who I also knew was a fan of those people, again, you're just stacking the deck and you're mitigating your risk as much as you can, knowing that as a producer, we're not getting paid a single dollar until we're physically making a movie. So all of this work that I'm doing is for free. I'm doing it on my own time. And if I'm going to spend my own time, I want to know that I'm marching down a path that I know has a really good chance of being successful. Because if I don't make the movie, I don't make any money at all. And so I think that is becoming incredibly necessary as a producer these days. And I think that as an investor, if you're aligning yourself with producers or other people that don't have that level of insight into the business, meaning they don't have those relationships, you're just not going to get there. You know, there have been projects that I know investors have bought scripts and hired their friends as producers, or hired producers that may look good on paper because they've got some credits. And then all of a sudden, 1 year later, they just cannot cast the movie. And that is partially because maybe those producers don't have the level of relationships that you thought they had within the talent agencies and with talent, where those agents are comfortable putting them into those movies. Because, you know, that is a big thing in town right now, like, of just making sure that if an agent is going to put their client in your movie, they know you, they trust you, you've delivered for them before, and they don't have to worry about a phone call coming from their client 6 months later going, who the hell is this guy? Why can we not get this movie made? What is going on? So I think that in this new version of Hollywood, that level of insight and that type of producer is 100% necessary to make things. It's required these days.
So interesting. It just goes to prove every industry is always changing, right? I had the guy on the podcast yesterday who took over Kinko's as CEO when they were losing. Like, he'd started the company that became GameStop, then he started a makeup company, sold for $120 million. Then he became the CEO of Kinko's when it was like in a turnaround. I think they were like losing $11 million a year. And he turned it around and sold it to FedEx for like $2.4 billion. And he's like, I got six main principles. And we're going through him. He's got this new book called Always Learning. Comes out like a month. But his last one, he said, was continuous improvement. And he said he'd just been in a debate with one of his good friends from Harvard from 40 years ago, and he started GameStop with him. And he's like, I decided it's got to change. He says that the sixth principle needs to change, instead of to continuous improvement, to continuous change. He's like, because if you continually improve at something, but things aren't that way anymore, it didn't really do good. He's like, and I realized you need to actually focus your staff around the fact of, like, we need to get good at our skill sets. But one of the skill sets is adaptation, is seeing the writing on the wall, like exactly what you guys have talked about, like getting the rumors, trying to verify, get the text, like get the information edge before, you know, Variety has reported about it, right? And
Hollywood has to evolve, has to consistently evolve, because audiences constantly evolve. They do. And I think right now Hollywood is, you know, is chasing Gen Z, right? Hollywood cannot figure out Gen Z, because Gen Z spends most of their time watching TikTok and YouTube. How do we compete with that? You know, we can't. Most of the content is made for $0. And that's what's getting the most of Gen Z eyeballs. And so right now, everyone in Hollywood is trying to figure out, how do we get Gen Z off their phones and off of YouTube and into a movie theater? And that is a challenge. And I think Hollywood is absolutely in the process of evolving right now to make that happen, because that is the biggest audience out there. Right now, it is the biggest audience out there. And if you can get them to show up, and leave their houses and put their phone down and get off YouTube and go to a movie theater, you will make an absolute fortune on whatever it is they're going to watch. And so to me, it's like, it's a big challenge for me and my company. We've been working on it, and we've got, I think, some solutions to that, and some content, I think, that and films that I think are going to get that audience out there. But Hollywood is absolutely in the process of evolving to get them, because I think Hollywood's biggest competition right now, you know, every studio's biggest competition is not Netflix, it's actually YouTube. YouTube is the biggest competition for Hollywood right now. It's where you're getting most of the eyeballs these days. And if we can figure out a way to get eyeballs off of YouTube and onto our stuff, I think that's going to be a winning formula right there. So you have a lot of producers in Hollywood trying to figure out how to get Gen Z right now. And it is a real challenge.
Well, listen, in our last minute here, Laura, what do you want to leave us with today?
Hire people that are proven within the industry and also have shown that they're not afraid to iterate. I think sometimes people in Hollywood, they operate with blinders on and they just think that things are always going to be the way that they've always been. And that kind of thinking will just, you know, go the way of the dinosaur. And, you know, I'm having conversations internally about the same things that Andy's mentioning. How can you gain a competitive edge in an industry that's in a moment of contraction? And I have some macro philosophies. One of them is like, you know, crossover entertainment. If you look at like, you know, the Taylor Swift movie, you know, you captured a whole audience and you got them into the theater because they were just so diehard, such diehard fans, you know, based on her Eras tour. But there are other ways, I think, to capture crossover audience from other channels that work. And that's the stuff I get paid to think about, so I can't talk about it here. But I would say that, you know, for people who are thinking about investing in the industry, work with proven people who have also demonstrated that they're not afraid to try something new. You know, with Andy, it was the podcast that people like really loved. And, you know, for me, it's also going into venture capital and just contemplating culture on a larger level than just the film and TV industry itself. And that brings in new conversations and new ways of thinking. And things are changing so fast that I think it's a requirement.
I actually really liked Brian Grazer's book about that, A Curious Mind.
That's
like, there was so much groupthink. He started... It was like podcasting before podcasts. He just didn't record it. He just had all these random conversations with people outside of Hollywood to get away from the groupthink. And obviously, it made him a lot of money. You guys, this is great. Can't wait for our next episode. Hope everybody enjoyed listening to this. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.